Thank you for joining me on this podcast of Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. I'm your host, Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy, and today we're going to be listening in to a TikTok Live describing cognitive dissonance. We'll also address issues like, is it okay to have people angry with us? And what if we find out we're married to someone who is a narcissist? Please don't forget to leave a review and subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. So let's listen in to this TikTok Live. So there are a few things I've had on my mind that I thought might be interesting, but I also want to make sure that I hear what's on your mind. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy. I'm a licensed psychologist who's had over 20 years of counseling experience, who now does full-time writing and content creating around narcissistic abuse. But one of the things I just recently heard was that just because someone is the most upset doesn't make them the most important person, and it doesn't make their issue the most important issue. I wondered how that strikes you. I know my reaction to it is, wow, how many times have I made that person the most important person because of their upsetness? It caused me fear. It caused me stress. And as a result, then I somehow contorted myself in order to make them happy, to show up, to keep them pleased, to deal with their issue, to fix it for them. And I wondered if you found yourself feeling as compelled, especially when you're in a relationship that's emotionally abusive, because those people, they, one, create a lot of drama, so they're often very upset, they're often hypercritical, and they want what they want when they want it, and they expect us to act like constellations around their issue. So I wondered if that's been your experience, and what does it feel like to hear that maybe we've gotten it wrong, that by making them the most important person and making their issues the most important issue, what does it feel like to consider that maybe that's back-ass word? Maybe we shouldn't be running things that way. I know what it does for me. When I think about not making that person the most important or their issue the most important, I feel stressed because I know that means there's going to be more drama. It means that I have to hold my ground harder, that I'm going to have to resist the pressure because they're going to increase the pressure to want to make their issue the issue. And so that's part of why I've made them the most important, because I feel like if I can address their issue, then I've cleaned the slate and keep things calm with them and then thus for myself. So it's not just simply because I don't think I count. It's because I don't want the hassle. And it's been easier just to deal with them as a way to help make life better for me. So I wondered if what your thoughts are about that, if you've encountered that, what you're thinking. But I also, for those of you who are new to me, who've not maybe been here before, I'm a psychologist with over 20 years of counseling experience. And here's a safe place for us to talk about all things related to narcissistic abuse, all things related to relationships. I also, by the way, am an author of a book called Love You More, The Harrowing Tale of Lies, Sex Addiction, and Double Cross, which is my personal experience of what I went through with narcissistic abuse, but I also am a child of a dysfunctional family. So I come from it from being raised in that, but I also then have been married to it. So I know it kind of from both sides, which is kind of interesting because there's another content creator who kind of took some of us on the last day or so talking about, and I'd love to know your opinion on this as well, about how they believe that anybody who's ever been into a narcissistic abusive relationship is because they've come out of a narcissistically abusive family. I don't agree with that. The research doesn't support that. But I do know that people like myself are a subset of that. That, yes, there are those of us who have that history. And then because we're used to it, we're acclimated, we end up getting into a situation like that. But I also know there are a lot of really great people who, because of how great you are, because of how easygoing and supportive and all of that, that you end up finding yourself in an abusive relationship because you've been accommodating. So to say that it's always out of a troubled childhood or a dysfunctional family has nothing to do with that. So Laura wants to know, is there advice for victims of anxious avoidance? Boy, I had a hard time saying that today. So let me kind of give you a little bit background of what she's asking, because this is an in-depth question that requires, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about or what she's referring to, gives you a little background. That comes out of attachment theory. There is two big researchers. One is Bowlby, and the other one's Ainsworth. So if you look them up, you'll see that they did this big, lots of research with infants and caretakers. And they looked at how infants dealt with strange situations with different types of caretakers. And they noticed as a result of that there were four different reactions. The infants kind of felt into four different categories. The best group was called the secure group. They're the group that when mom left the room and then they came back, they were a little concerned, but they reunited. I'm having a hard talking today. They reunited well, they connected well, and they felt free to explore the room. When there's a stranger that came into the room, they acted appropriate to that stranger. They weren't hyperly afraid, but they also weren't clingy. They didn't do anything kind of strange. That's called the secure group. There's another group called the anxiously attached group. This group was the group that when they didn't want mom to leave, they kind of clung, they cried a long time. When she came back, they acted kind of anxious. They tried to fuss over her, make sure she's okay, check in with her. And I know I'm being using gender specific words because this was done in the mid 1920s when most women were the primary caregiver. So it was looking at women and their children or mothers and children, but it's applicable to fathers or other primary caregivers. What they found was these couple, the dyad, the mother-baby dyad, maybe something went wrong. It could have been maybe the mom was depressed. Maybe there wasn't a great match between mother and baby. Maybe there's drama happening in the family, like someone was ill and mom couldn't attend. But for whatever reason, the baby felt like it needed to do a lot of work to keep a connection. Then there is called the avoidance group. The avoidance group were infants that didn't seem to care when mother left the room. And when she came back, they almost seemed to kind of punish her. They sort of avoided her, stayed far away. And, they didn't really kind of connect very well. They seemed to sort of like have this separate relationship. What they suspected about that group is, for whatever reason, these were children who felt like the relationship was too intense or too risky, and they kept their distance. And they stayed detached, and they kind of like were uninvolved. And again, there's who knows why there's, different reasons for people, infants, to do this. It could have been mom's too intense. Maybe she's in her face and in their space and overwhelmed them. Maybe the baby's hypersensitive and just doesn't know how to manage stimulation very well. Maybe, I don't know, maybe whatever happened that kind of resulted in the child feeling it was safer to sort of keep distance. So they sort of learned that relationships are risky and to stay away. There's a third group called anxious avoidant, or also disorganized. That is a group where they kind of acted hit and miss with mom. They would like look to her and then they'd kind of be, concerned or distrusting. They were very vigilant. They sort of stayed on guard, like they weren't quite sure what's happening next. And they concluded that group probably was in an abusive situation, that the parents were hit and miss, that sometimes they showed up, things were great, things were safe, and then there were other times when it wasn't okay, and they had to always stay on guard. They could never fully relax. They were very alert to what was happening in the room. So, come back to Laura's question. What do you give to advice for victims who have an anxious and avoidant attachment style? So I have some great news. These styles fluctuate. You can heal. These are not fixed. And there are very good questionnaires that you can find on the internet. I don't have a link to one, but I've seen them. In fact, I was a part of a longitudinal study looking at attachment styles. So that every month, this research group looked at my attachment style, kind of asked me some questions about what was happening in my life. And it was interesting because it's happened for 2 years, and you could see how I moved about depending on what was going on in my life. There might be times I was a little more anxious. There might be times I was a little more avoidant. There was times I was pretty secure. So I really kind of moved about. So that's the good news, guys, is just because you're anxiously avoidant right now, or that you're anxious or you're avoidant, doesn't mean that that's forever. It just means where you're at this moment. So I think what's really helpful for this is to kind of look at what has caused you to feel distrusting. What are your triggers that make you feel like you're going on alert and you're waiting for something bad to happen? I know for me, especially coming out of this last marriage, I know that there are things that, when I start to feel trusting towards someone and I'm starting to get to know somebody and I want to hope that things are going good, I get kind of scared that maybe I'm you know, moving too fast or getting a little uncomfortable. I kind of like, you know, I get anxious around it. So by being aware of that, that helps me then to talk to myself. They also found that those who wrote things down, like journaling, you know, journaling your feelings, it does just tremendous help. It helps you to sort of like hear your thoughts in a different way, to sort of see it on paper. It externalizes what's happening inside and also gives you a chance to validate how accurate it is. So I'd really encourage you to journal about what's making you feel distrusting or vigilant or unsafe, and talk about that with yourself and see if that's helpful. So those are some things that I would do that would be helpful to that. And of course, I always think therapy is a good idea, that for you to talk to someone safe so you could have a place to process these feelings. So I hope that's helpful, Laura, and some ideas about it. Yeah, you said you're asking as the person who is the victim of that person. Yeah, I kind of understood that you're talking about yourself. You're talking about what happened to you. I understand that it is kind of scary. And by the way, anxious avoidant attachment is sort of the more harder one, because when you're distrusting, you're expecting to not be able to trust. You're expecting something to go wrong and you're looking for it. And I know that when it has gone wrong and you have a track record of that, it's really easy to assume that it's going to go wrong again. And then it makes you almost look for it, like you're anticipating it. And there's something that happens with self-fulfilling prophecy. Like when let's take another situation. So if you anticipate someone's not going to like you and you see a funny expression cross their face, you're going to think, oh, they don't like me. Well, we don't really know what they're thinking. They could be thinking about, oh, I don't want such and such for dinner tonight. And I know that my family is making that. And it could be unrelated to you altogether, but because we're anticipating that, then we look for it and then we see it as reinforcement, even when it really actually isn't good information. So those are some of the things that you can think about as a way to sort of work through that, is to sort of challenge it. Like, are you mind reading? Well, you can't mind read. So you can't anticipate what really is going on. All you know is what you know right now with yourself. Lucy wants to know, how do I know if my husband's a narcissist? Well, the DSM-5, especially since narcissism was first diagnosed in 1980, doesn't mean it wasn't around till then. It was. It just is we didn't have a label for it. So in 1980 was the first time we had a formal label in the United States. Doesn't mean like we'd been recognizing it since the late 1800s, I believe. But that's when it was first called narcissistic personality disorder. And there are 9 criteria that people qualify. And I know I'm not going to mention all 9 of them. I'm not going to think of it. But what they include is, this person thinks they're entitled, that the rules don't apply to them. They look for special treatment. They have excessive pride. They lack empathy in other people. They tend to be exploitive and use people in their relationships. They tend to be prone to envy of others. Those are just some that come right off the top of my head. So the only way for you to really know is that your husband would need to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist for diagnosis, because those are technically not that a medical doctor could diagnose them, but they're not likely. They're gonna defer to a mental health professional. So they will need to see a mental health professional, and the mental health professionals that can diagnose are psychologists and psychiatrists. But that doesn't mean you can't know that you're being narcissistically abused. So, and I know somebody else asked that question, so I'm going to answer that question by answering your question as well. How do you know you're being narcissistically abused, and how does that differ from emotional abuse or other forms of abuse? Well, narcissistic abuse is, there's a lot we don't understand about it, but there's some things that we're beginning to know more about it, and that is there's a lot of cognitive dissonance. What is that? Well, cognitive dissonance is something we encounter all the time in life. Like today, if you had lunch, because it's after lunch for me, you might have thought, do I want a sandwich or am I going to have a salad? And for a moment, you have this angst, like what's better? How many calories can I afford? What am I going to eat tonight? And you have this tension as you make this decision. That tension is cognitive dissonance. And then you resolve it. You make a decision, you choose whatever, and you eat it, and you move on. So the way we resolve the distress is we make a decision. Well, the problem with some people when we meet them is because they're not really who they say they are, because of their own insecurity and fragility as a person, as a self, they hide. And they create a lot of And they do a lot of like offloading of emotional distress. So they don't own their problems. They don't own their feelings. They don't manage distress well. They make a lot of impulsive decisions and then they don't own their actions. And the result, they don't really present authentically. And that creates distress for us. We sense something's wrong, something's off. And as a result, we feel cognitive dissonance and it doesn't go away. It just changes. There's a great book called Why Can't I Just Leave by Dr. Kristen Milstead. I know you guys have been asking for books. I highly recommend this book. And guys, I'm going to tell you something. I'm super excited. I have not announced it, so you're the first to hear it. She's agreed to be interviewed by me. So I'm going to be hosting a live webinar, I believe, with her. I need to work out the details. But Dr. Milstead is going to take our questions. I'm so excited, guys. This book... In fact, I have it right here in front of me. I think it's one of the best books out there. It was just published in November of 2021. And you need to get this book. If you're struggling with narcissistic abuse, Dr. Kristen Milstead is awesome. She went through it herself. She's a psychologist. She's also an educator. She has an incredible, when you hear her credentials, it's like, wow, seriously. And she just got a hold of me on Monday and said, yes, I'm interested in an interview. So I'm going to be hosting that probably later this summer. Like I said, I got to work out the details. But she describes there are three stages of cognitive dissonance that we go through when we get into one of these relationships that's kind of unique to narcissistic abuse. The first one is you make a discovery that you thought you knew somebody. I'll hold the book up again. You thought you knew the person. It's called Why Can't I Just Leave? Why Can't I Just Leave? The Guide to Waking Up and Walking Out of a Pathological Love Relationship. Her last name is Milstead, Kristen Milstead, Kristen Milstead. She herself was in a narcissistic abusive relationship, and she was a psychologist like me. So my story tells the story of what happened. Her story tells the story of why we get stuck. So mine is called Love You More, The Harrowing Tales of Lies, Sex Addiction, and Double Cross. So I give you an inside look of what it's like to be in an abusive relationship. She kind of tells you her story, but she really spends a lot of time breaking it out. All the research that we now currently know, which is not enough, that's part of the problem. And then she begins to tell you what happens with narcissistic abuse. So there are three stages that she's identified that we go through when you realize that you've married someone or you're in a relationship with somebody that is not who they really present themselves to be. The first is you think, is this person good or are they bad? Do I know who they are? And you feel this like incredible shock, like you're this just big question. Like that's how I felt like when I discovered that my ex had been completely lying about everything, I actually thought, do I even know him? He felt like a stranger to me. Here I'd known him over a year and I was like going through every date. Like, you know, what really happened? This is what I think happened. Is that what happened? I don't know if that's what happened. So that's the first stage, is you have questions about the person you're in a relationship with. The next stage is you find yourself thinking, should I stay or should I go? Is this really like a good relationship? How do I know when we're over? How do I know when we're not savable at all? How do I know maybe they don't even want to be in the relationship? I think they do. They're here. They're coming home. But do they? I don't know. And then the last stage is you get into saying, okay, apparently something is really wrong. And they're giving me all sorts of mixed messages. And it's gotten really awful. And I know I should leave, but I don't know why I'm not leaving. Why am I still here? What's wrong with me that I can't leave? And so she kind of talks about the final stages when we feel like we face our own betrayal. We kind of wake up and we look at ourselves and think, I don't even know who I've become. Now, the horrible part of all of this is that it creates cognitive dissonance over a long period of time. And this is where they're doing a lot of research right now. There's a whole lot of research. There's not a lot known and there's not a lot of treatment for it. But what we have discovered is that it creates brain damage. Are we surprised? Because anybody of you who've gotten stuck in it, you realize that your mental fog, you're not making the decisions as well as you used to. You're forgetful. your, you know, the things that used to be simple for you are not simple anymore. And you know that you're not yourself. You know that something's wrong. And of course, then the abusive person is saying, yeah, I always knew this about you, which makes you feel really worse. And the other thing is you develop imposter syndrome. You end up thinking you're not who you think you are. And you're not who anybody else thinks that you are, and that maybe you're not even anybody at all. You just feel kind of completely run down. The abuse is doing that to you, but also the cognitive dissonance is doing that to you. So they're both doing that to you. So this is what she talks about. It's amazing. I'm so excited about this night. So I will start as time, you know, as I work it out, I'll start to tell you more about that interview when that's going to happen so you guys can come and join it. I'd be really excited to see you. But back to the question. So back to the question, do I know my husband's a narcissist? You may not know if your spouse is a narcissist or not, but what you can know is what's happening to you. You can know if you're feeling dismissed, invalidated. Are you feeling crazy? So yeah, so those, I can't answer your question about is your partner a narcissist, but I can help you to think about whether or not what you're going through is narcissistic. So I hope that helped. I know that was a long ass answer for that. How do you deal with someone who holds grudges? Yeah, that's a real hardship. You know, I'm kind of having to think about this one for a second. So holding grudges is really about safety. You know, it's a way for you to say, someone hurt me, even maybe it's not legitimate. Not everybody, we get upset about things that maybe aren't really, we've misunderstood, or maybe that person didn't mean to be offensive. There's lots of reasons why we have issues with somebody. But when we hold on to a grudge, it's really a way for us to, it's about retribution. We feel like somehow things aren't fair and we want the scales to balance. It was like an injury. Have you guys ever heard of what's called a narcissistic wound? By the way, we are all on the scale of narcissism. We're somewhere on it. No one doesn't have narcissistic traits. It's a normal developmental phase. Yes, there's some suspicion that may be related to genetics. Maybe it's related to upbringing, types of upbringing. But we all have the same challenges of we all want to know that we're special. We all want to be understood. So we're somewhere on the spectrum. But as a result of that, we are sensitive to how things make us feel psychologically. So someone is offensive, we take that personal, and how personally we take it depends on how fragile we feel about ourselves, how insecure we maybe are about ourselves. So to me, grudge holding is an extension of that. It's a way of saying, wow, I feel like I can't redeem myself from the injury enough that I need to make sure I work it out with you so that you hurt the way that you've hurt me, even if you didn't mean it. I know. Isn't that sad? So to me, a person who's grudge holding is not a very safe person, and I would be careful around that individual. What's the key to healthy communication? Abstract artist Kelsey wants to know. That's a great question. I love that question. The really one is healthy communications is talking between yourself and someone else and having them understand what you're saying. So there's what you say, there's what gets translated from what actually is said. You may think you're saying something, but maybe you didn't say it. It's what goes in between the two of you, and then there's what the person hears. So it can go wrong at three levels. Maybe you think you're saying it, but it's not actually being communicated very well. And then maybe you actually said it well, but the person's grid, the way they hear things, they're hearing it through a different grid. Let me give an example of how that happens. I was in buying a tool with my late husband, and I didn't know something. And the way I deal with it when I'm in Home Depot is I say to the salesman, I don't know much about XYZ. Can you help me with this? And my late husband said, shh, don't do that. Don't do that. That says that I don't know anything either. And then that's an insult to me. Well, that's not how I ever saw anything, but I'm not a man and I'm not supposed to, I don't need to know everything about tools. But I didn't know by me doing that, that I was somehow like communicating something about him that was hurtful. I didn't know that. So see how I thought that what I was asking was, and if I was alone, it would have been totally innocuous. I don't care if the salesman doesn't think I don't know anything about the tools. I don't know anything about the tools. But I didn't know that I had meaning maybe in a man's world or at least in that world or at least in that culture or in that state. I didn't know that. And so there's what I was saying and then there's how he was hearing it and it was being taken differently. So healthy communication is breaking that down, is understanding what's happening between you. And here's something I want to kind of throw this out here, and I know that may be this a little controversial, But men and women hear things differently. And part of the reasons we hear things differently is because our brain is literally wired differently. Do we have two hemispheres? And in between these two hemispheres, there's a kind of like a highway, a roadway that connects the two. It's called the corpus callosum. The way that they're structured between men and women is differently. So women's talks, our two hemispheres talk to each other more. We have kind of like a super highway that runs back and forth. Men's are not. Now, if you think about this in evolutionary terms, it makes sense. So if you're into a hunter-gatherer world and you need to be super safe, you're going to want someone who's hunting to be focused on the hunt. You don't want them noticing other things around because that would distract them from getting food. But if you're the person back taking care of young children or managing multiple, you know, things, you'd want to be very hyper aware of what's happening all around you and hearing everything, right? So you'd want to be attending to that. So that's a way in which the kind of things, you know, kind of see different. A person who was researching this was a social linguist by the name of Deborah Tannen. She did a lot of work in the 1990s and some in the 2000s. So that's just a biological difference between brains. Now, there's a lot more that we know about. There's a lot of subtleties, like what happens with ADHD brains versus autistic brains. And there's, you know, even with a narcissistic brain, and we're finding out a whole lot of things about how, like, for example, narcissists tend to have a certain area of the brain that is not as sensitive to cognitive dissonance. So that disconnect, the incongruency that would bother somebody else doesn't bother them. So as a result, we don't always hear things. That's my big point. We don't always hear things. So what do we do about that? I highly recommend that you break it down. That when something's going wrong and it's getting really heated, one thing they found with John Gottman's work is that if you can take a 20-30 minute break and say, hey, you know, we're getting heated and I know that we're now talking around each other, let's just take a break. Let's step away. And then can we come back and talk about it again? And then check in 30 minutes. And if things are still not cool enough, take another 30 minutes. But make sure you set a timer and that you come back and finish it. And maybe sometimes writing it out, like, my issue is this. I'm really struggling with this. And you, what are you hearing me say? So sometimes by actually breaking it into segments really helps kind of like identify where things can go wrong. So I hope that's helpful. The next question is, how do you enforce boundaries with your narcissist? This is a really fascinating thing, and I know why it was tough for me, but I'd love to hear maybe why it's tough for you guys. I'll go watch for the comments for you guys. The reason boundaries are hard is because we hope people will respect the boundary. So we say a boundary and we say, please don't do blah blah blah, or please do blah blah blah. And then we hope the other person has enough sense of caring for us that they do it. The problem is when you are in a relationship with a toxic person, they don't have that. And so they're not going to respect it. And in fact, they're going to push it. And they may even get fun pushing it. They may have pleasure with upsetting you. So that means then we have to do something about the disregard of the boundary. So where we get stuck with it is we ask for boundaries we can't ourselves enforce. Did you get that? You are asking for a boundary that you yourself can't enforce. So don't ever set a boundary that you can't follow through on. So let me give you back an example with my relationship with my ex. He was cheating. I needed to set a boundary around that. It's not okay to be, you know, to be cheating. So one of the therapists we were involved with wanted me to say the next time he cheated or I caught anything that was remotely like that, I was going to walk out. But I wasn't ready to walk out. I wasn't convinced that we were over yet. You know, it takes time for someone to get there, and I wasn't there yet. So for me to say that as a boundary would have been silly, because then the minute that I caught him, then I would be stuck, and then he knows everything I said doesn't mean anything. I had basically invalidated myself and showed myself no respect, and therefore he's not going to respect me. So what would be better is for me to say, if I catch you again, I'm going to do this, like we're going to have a therapy session, or I'm kicking you out for the weekend, or whatever it is. I mean, what you do doesn't so much matter. It's the fact that you have to do something, you have to say something you actually can do. Like, say, for example, you're riding with someone who drives really recklessly and that scares you. You can say, next time you start to scare me, I'm going to ask you to pull over. I'm going to call an Uber. And then you have to be prepared that you're going to do that. Because I'm going to tell you something, they're going to do that. They're going to do something that then makes you have to follow through with what you're saying. They're going to test you to make sure that you really mean it. And if you don't follow through, then they know, oh, that person's all full of hot air. They're just threatening. And then it will get worse. So that's where we get stuck with boundaries, is make sure you set a boundary you can hold. Never say a boundary that you can't. If you're not ready, I don't care who says you should or shouldn't, don't set the boundary. Do not set the boundary. And it's the same with kids. I agree. It's the same with kids. So yeah, it's really tough, but that's the only way to make it work. And don't let anyone push you on what your boundary should be, because boundaries really are just a fancy way of saying where you start and somebody else stops. And that's just all that what a boundary really is. It's like me, I don't like peas. My boundaries is please don't feed me peas. I will pick them out if I find them. You know, it's just something about me. And when you say, oh, okay, I care, I'm saying I care about that. That's what who you are and that's what you're about. So I wish they weren't called boundaries, because I think it's really a misname. So Brooklyn wants to know, what books do I recommend for clinical psychology? Are you talking about graduate level books, like books on what? Because by the way, psychology is massive. So when you say clinical psychology, that says to me you're talking about like pathologies, like diseases, mental diseases. And I really don't know off the top of my head what those would be. Those would be things that you would see in a graduate study, like you took psychopathology. That's what I would look as, great books on psychopathology. And then they would list every disorder. And then you could read up like, what is a bipolar disorder? What is depression? What is anxiety? Those types of things. That's what they're called, psychopathology. It means things that go wrong in the head. That's what it means. But yeah, so I don't know if that's what you mean, or if you're talking about specific books in another area of psychology. I don't know. But off the top of my head with clinical psychology, it's kind of a little long in the past for me graduate school, so I don't really can't think of them. And I know there's more books that are more up to date at this level. By the way, though, I do have a mental resource list that's listed in my link in my bio. So if you go there, at the top, it's in writing. You click on it, it will take you to the books, and I break it down by books for parents who have parenting, people who are parenting with narcissists, people who are living with one, people who think they are one, people who have parents who are one. And then I also have other books just listed on other topics. So if you are looking for something that's kind of helpful, I do list them out by that. So Tahima Hall Williams wants to know, is narcissism an epidemic, or is it that we're getting better at diagnosing it? I think both. I do think that it's on the rise. We're not quite for sure why. It could be because of the cultural, you know, sort of the zeitgeist, the healthiness of our culture. It could also be, some people think it's related to social media, the fact that we've made influencers and content creators as if that's like a thing, and there's something really awesome about that. So, you know, that's part of that maybe why. It could be just, but it does seem to be on that. I have heard that the statistics used to be 0.5 to 1%. Now they've risen where we think it's closer to 6%. But now even Dr. Romani thinks that it might be even more than 25 to 30% of the population might be on the spectrum, like far down the line on the spectrum. So what I do know is anybody who's a narcissistic abuser, they tend to abuse many people. So as a result, there's a lot of victims. So that if people say, how can narc talk be so big? Well, because when you are a person who's like having lots of supply, you're going through lots of people, and then there's going to be lots of victims. That's how it works. So you might be one person, but you might offend or hurt 50 people. So you do that for every, you know, 100 people times 50, that's a lot of people. That's why there's so many of us who are talking about this. It's unfortunately, a lot of pain. I think we are getting better at identifying abuse, but I also think we've gotten, because of how anonymous things are and how casual we can treat each other, and even like looking and trolling that happens here, it's kind of gotten okay to be cruel and hurtful. We don't really, there's not a lot of accountability when there's anonymous, you know? So that's some of my thoughts about that. We really don't know is the answer. I'm isolate to cope. How do I change this? Well, unfortunately, the best way to change something is to change it. One of the things that we have used to believe, I know I used to believe this, and we kind of like perpetuate this in public. We think that You have to wait for your feelings to change in order for you to change. So I have to wait for myself to feel better about, like, for example, I got to go work out today. I ask myself, do I want to go work out? The answer, of course, most of the time is going to be no, I don't want to. And then I wait for my feelings to change until I want to go out, then I work out, then I'll go work out. The problem is, how many times do you think I'm going to actually go work out, right? Not. I'm not. Because I'm not going to feel like I want to. But if we begin to do the new action and repeatedly do the action, then we end up finding out that we actually, our feelings change about it. So I might find I really like the experience and then I want to do it more. So I'm saying that to say that one of the ways to be less isolated is to deliberately make opportunities for you to be less isolated. And I'm glad you're here because this is a form of, you're not isolated here. We're actually talking to each other. And you're in a room full of 120 other people talking to each other. So that's cool that you're doing that. And you're already doing this less. Yeah, somebody else said something about how when they're triggered, they want to isolate. That's the way you handle your feelings. It's good to know that about yourself. There's nothing wrong with isolating as a way to process emotion. But I think when you see yourself kind of moving more into like scared and anxious or avoidant, you know, to kind of look at how can you like just break that down. Do I do virtual therapy sessions? I stopped counseling in 2015 when my late husband was diagnosed with cancer. So I was counseling for up to 20 years by then, and I just needed a change. And plus I was grieving and processing all the losses in my life, and I've not returned. I don't plan to return to counseling. So that's a long answer question to say, no, I don't. But on the other hand, I know it's tough to find good therapists. I know that. And I have a list. So if you are looking for help for either a life coach or a therapist, please DM me on Instagram, same handle, and I'd be happy to refer you to some people. So if you're looking, if you just get stuck, because one of the things that's happening, I don't know if you guys have noticed that a lot of clinicians don't know much about narcissistic abuse because we've been trained to look at the individual. We don't really look at people who are not in the room. When you come in and start telling me about something that's happening to you with somebody else, well, I can't really control that person, so I typically don't deal with it. So as a result, a lot of therapists are not up to date. It's a new thing. Narcissistic abuse is a new thing. It's a valid thing. We're realizing that we do need to have treatment protocols for abuse that's happening to the person who's in the room. But as a result, it kind of can be hit and miss. There are some things that you can ask for to help to find a good therapist. Look for someone who's called trauma-informed. You want them trauma-informed. Another kind of code word to use with clinicians is to say, I'm looking for someone to help me with betrayal trauma. Or you might actually ask them right outright with saying, what do you know about narcissistic abuse? What's your familiarity with that? Do you deal much with that? So those are the things that I would ask when I'm looking for someone who's informed with this. By the way, guys, thank you so much for hanging out with me today. These are really awesome questions. I appreciate that. Can someone with PTSD really change with therapy? Yes, they can. I know there's a lot of work going on in that. There's also a lot of work looking at CPTSD. What is it? How is it different? What's the treatment protocol for that? So I've been looking into the research lately. It's fascinating. But yes, the upshot is yes. One of the things that I'm hearing, and I think it's really interesting, is that a lot of therapy can be left brain. Left brain tends to be more talk therapies where we kind of like process, but you want to have therapies that are also right-brained oriented. That's why writing is so helpful, art therapy is helpful, anything that kind of uses more sensory motor, EMDR is very useful. I know there's some clinicians who are doing a little more body work that might be helpful, so you want to do something that kind of like connects both hemispheres and gets you to kind of like be more integrated. So I would, you know, look for that kind of help. Yeah, right. It needs to be both brains, guys. It needs to be both right and left brain. The work that you do, it's really the most helpful. And I know a lot of therapies has been primarily more left brain oriented. Like cognitive behavioral therapy is awesome, but it's not, it's all left brain. It's not left and right. So you want to do something kind of, you're going to probably have to have different modalities. Work not only with a talk therapist, but also work with some other types of therapy as well. Krista wants to know, what does codependency look like? And thank you. This is one of my pet peeves. I'm really glad you asked me this. You have noticed that I have not used it once here. There's a reason why I'm not using it, because I don't because it, I don't believe that it really, I know there are clinicians who like to talk about it, who see it as part of this. I don't. This is why. Codependency came out of an addiction model. It's what they noticed when they started working with families of addicts. They found that the whole family gets sick with the addict. There's a lot of behavior that happens in order to try to control the addict's addiction. So, for example, if you're living with an alcoholic, you might stop limiting the amount of alcohol in the house. You might change what kind of activities you might do. You might find a way that you're going to call the boss and call in for them why they didn't make it to work. You're going to start to do things to sort of moderate, mitigate, you know, ameliorate their troubled behavior. And as a result, that makes you sick when you do it too. You become a part of the addiction system and it makes you very ill. And that's why AA has Al-Anon, is to help the partners look at how they have been trying to manage their partner's addiction. It makes you become codependent, a part of that problem. That all had to do with addiction. That's where it started from. If you go back to Melanie Beatty, Codependency No More, it's about addiction. It's not about people pleasing, and it's not about abuse. That's a different thing. But we've kind of commingled the term as if they're the same thing and they're not. That's why I don't use it, because I'm really uncomfortable, because what it does, this is what it does. It says that people who end up in an abusive relationship asked for it, that they were sick themselves, which is why they picked the person. And then they stayed with the person because they are people pleasers and they don't know how to set limits. And do you see what I'm saying? It completely misses what happens. And I know there's a lot of misunderstandings and myths around this. I know that. But if you look at like Kristen Milstead's books, Why Can't I Just Leave? If you look at Don Hennessy's book, How He Gets Into Her Head, and he is a law enforcement in Ireland who works with domestic abuse victims. If you look at Sandra Brown's research out of Purdue, you're going to find that that's completely not true. It's a myth. It is something we applied over here on a different topic, and we're now using it to talk about something else. And it does something really dangerous. AA is an Alcoholic Anonymous. It does really something dangerous when we do this. We are not looking at how someone ends up in an abusive situation. Yeah, those books that I just listed Why Can't I Just Leave with Kristen Milstead. Why Can't I Just Leave? The other one is Don Hennessy's book. I have it in front of me. See if I can find it. Called How He Gets Into Her Head. This book, guys, is awesome. It's awesome. Don Hennessy is a law enforcement officer in Ireland. How He Gets Into Her Head. He actually is. It's on 20 years worth of research working with domestic violence families, situations. What he found, and he says something super powerful that I love. He says, when we call and look at the victims and say there's something wrong with the victims, when we say they're insecure, they have a troubled background, they're people pleasing, what are we not doing? We're not looking at those who are offending. We're now focused on in the wrong direction. And we're missing that somebody actually did the offending and got this person into a relationship. Because what happens is, and this is true whether or not they actually get, you know, criminally charged or not, all kinds of abuse, there's a setup, there's the grooming, and then there's the actual offense. So they have found that people who end up in these abusive relationships, that those who do the offending are using cult-like programming. If you end up in a narcissistic relationship, guys, you've been brainwashed. You've been brainwashed. I'm not using that word lightly, and I have heard many other clinicians use it as well. You've had techniques and strategies used on you that the government uses to break someone down, that cults uses to get people into an occult. You met somebody who's not real. You met somebody who adopted your mannerism and made you feel all that, and then they slowly relinquished it and began to work away at your identity to make you think that you're not all that. They begin to slowly erode your confidence and your belief in yourself until you are completely stressed and you no longer know yourself. Yet I bet the person in Raging Princess, I bet you grew up in a cult, I bet you see some of the same mechanisms used in the occult that narcissists or toxic people use with their families, with their love partners. They do the same thing. So that's why I don't use the word codependency. I will never put them together in the same conversation because I don't believe they belong together. I think it's a complete misuse of the label. I know there's a lot of creators who do that. That's fine. I just don't think it doesn't work. And it's victim blaming. And I'm not okay with that. I'm really not okay with that. Does parent abuse as a child cause cognitive dissonance? Absolutely. It doesn't really matter the relationship. It could be your neighbor could cause cognitive dissonance. You might have a really horrible neighbor who's messing with the garbage cans out front, or maybe reporting you to the community guidelines or whatever. It could be whatever. It could be a boss. It could be your child's doing it to you. The relationship dyad doesn't matter. What matters is what's happening. It's that you're feeling attacked. You're feeling crazy. You're not for sure what's going on. You're being misled. So yeah, it can happen in all sorts of directions. I know it happens in families. It happens at work. It happens in communities. It can happen at a church. It really doesn't matter the system. Any system that there are people and people dynamics, we can have cognitive dissonance. So how to help an emotionally abusive marriage? Krista, this is a tough question. It's tough because there isn't any way to help other than you setting your own boundaries and holding it and protecting yourself and you learning how to sort of like care for yourself better. Somebody just asked, how do you avoid turning everything into an argument? You cannot avoid this with anybody. If somebody's going to make an issue, they'll find a way to make an issue, even if you just look wrong, frankly, seriously. I'm trying to think, what can I say here and what can I not say? My personal life with my ex was awful. He was very avoidant, intimacy avoidant, and always. And I might say, hey, I'm in the mood. And he would find the most horrific excuses to blame me, make me look like shit, turn around, make me awful. You can't avoid it. If they want to create a problem, they're going to create a problem. So what you can do is your exposure to it, like how long you're staying, why are you staying, what is your answers to the issues, what kind of boundaries are you going to be holding on to? And here's the question I'm seeing a lot of you commenting on it, is that you deserve a good life. You deserve a life that you are you. You are made more. Is this good for you? And if those of you who can come back in and say, yeah, but we have kids, you think really that's helping the kids? Yeah, I know divorce is never a good thing. And as a psychologist, I don't like seeing divorce, but I also know that what they're seeing is toxic as hell. They're not seeing real intimacy. They're seeing somebody being not allowed to be fully themselves, and they're learning that safety doesn't exist. And here's the other bad thing. They're also walking on eggshells. And do you think they can go to church or work, school and function? Do you think they go to school and try to learn? They have the mental space to go and think and be kids and play and not worry about what's going on home. I was just in a live webinar, and if you guys want a playback, there's an awesome webinar that was just a part of last week called How to Recognize and Overcome Narcissistic Abuse. I need to put a link in my bio because you can buy the replay of that. One of the questions that came up in the seminar was, does it matter if mom and dad are not getting along? Do the kids know it? Does it count? And one of the narcissists, self-aware narcissists, said, I see my relationship with my wife is different than my relationship with the kids. And I actually stopped this person and said, wait a minute. Kids need to know that their home is safe. They cannot focus on outside things, imagination and play and learning, when there is tension in the house, because they feel like something's going to go wrong. And if it goes wrong, that means it goes wrong for them. They can't focus. You're interfering with their safety. So you're not doing the kids a favor by staying, by having this toxic environment. And I know that doesn't, I know you're never getting rid of this person because you have kids together. That means you have to parent them for the rest of your life. But I do think it would be great to have periods of time where they can relax, play, be themselves, and know that all of this tension is gone. So it comes back to, what's holding you? What are you afraid of? And I've been there. It took me more than a year to leave. I'm a psychologist. I knew I was in something that was terribly awful. And yet I had a hard time actually doing it. The closer I got to the line to leaving, the grayer, the fuzzier it felt to me. So I get this is a very hard thing that we're talking about. I get it. I get it. It's not easy. I'm not making it easy. But those are some things to think about. You're not going to change the person you're with. They are who they are. It is what you're going to do about it. Now, I will give you a big tip on how to communicate with very toxic people. Gray rock, someone mentioned it already, but this is what it looks like. You say as little as possible, as blandly as possible, and you keep it short. Like, so what do you want to do tonight? I'm open. Well, so you want to do this? Well, you let me know what you want to do and then we'll do it. Or how come that didn't happen? I don't know. Don't make it snarky. Don't have any passive aggressiveness in it. Keep it, you know, cool and level, but keep it bland. And that's and repetitive. Here's the other big piece. Repetitive, repetitive, repetitive. Like, are we going to go to the neighbors tonight? No, I'm not interested. Well, I really want to go to the neighbors tonight. That's okay. I'm just not interested. Don't you think we should go to the neighbors tonight? I'm not interested. You just over. Because one of the things they find is they can't deal with repetition. They literally can't. So you'll throw them off and you'll kind of like squelch it if you do that. So that's another good tip is just figure out what it is that you want to say, what your point is, your stance is on something. Hold that ground. Say it over and over and to the point that you are bored silly by it. And by you doing it, they get bored. They don't know what to do with that. They're looking for you to be conflictual and you're just not. So yes, do be careful. I do agree with Super Sloth Louise, but be careful. You don't want to have, there are people that would be antagonistic. I'm not saying that. You know the person you're in a relationship way better than I do. You know if it'll work or not work. So can I speak on narcissists with borderline personality disorder? Yeah, that's a great question. I know that I don't know how much you follow Sam Vanknin. There's what's called Cluster B personality disorders. That includes narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, and histrionic personality disorder. They're all considered Cluster B, which now we're starting to call them antagonistic because they're non-agreeable personality styles. It's how they relate to each other people is antagonistically. Some people are theorizing that we shouldn't have made them separate personality disorders, that maybe they're part of all one way of relating, but it's more state or fluctuating. Maybe it's more depending on what's going on. I've witnessed it where someone who has more narcissistic suddenly could have something very catastrophic happen, threw them way off, and they start to be dysregulated like a borderline. Or I've seen a borderline who usually is very dysregulated and upset suddenly become calculating and very antisocial, very ruthless. So they tend to be kind of like they can fluctuate around each other. That's one of the things that Sam Vanknin on YouTube, he's a self-aware malignant narcissist. He's a professor and does a lot of teaching on this. He also wrote the book Malignant Self-Love, Narcissism Revisited. He's theorizing that possibly these disorders move in and out depending on states, depending on what's happening, depending on how safe they feel. So I wouldn't be surprised to see someone who's pretty narcissistic. So what's the difference? The big difference between a narcissistic personality style and a borderline personality style is how they handle emotions. Narcissists tend to compartmentalize and cut off. They're very disjointed, disconnected to their feelings. They're feeling them, but they control their feelings by cutting them off and denying them or projecting them or compartmentalizing. Whereas borderline personality disorders, they become overrun by them. They like are emotional storms and they are very reactive, very impulsive. So you'll see this radical acting out. A good example of that is, I know it's an older movie now, it's Fatal Attraction. The Glenn Close character has BPD, whereas the Michael Douglas character is more of an NPD. So he's kind of cut off and estranged from his feelings. He's more ruthless in what he's doing. And yet she's like, you know, boiling the rabbit, doing really wild things. So that's a good example. But that doesn't mean you can't push someone who's a narcissist into behaving like a borderline when they're very, very upset, when they get dysregulated, when they feel betrayed, when they have a big narcissistic wound. So that's my thoughts on it. I think maybe they're not as fixed as we think that they are. How do you cope with a narcissist who's projecting? Well, so projection is a defense mechanism. It is whenever there's something that we feel like Sam Vaknin, V-A-K-N-I-N, is the YouTuber. He's on YouTube. His library is immense. So if you want really great information to go to YouTube, look for Sam Vaknin's channel, V-A-K-N-I-N. Thank you, Luis, for spelling it for us. So the question of projection, there are at least like 12 plus, 20 plus defense mechanisms. It's how we cope with things that stress us, things that make us feel internally uncomfortable. So like if I get caught in a lie and I really feel uneasy with myself, I'm going to do something to sort of soothe myself. I may say I never did it. That's denial. I may put it away in somewhere far away and not like mentally shelve it. That's compartmentalization. I may actually say, you're the liar. I didn't lie. You misunderstood me. That's projection. I could say, oh, I had a bad day. That's rationalization. I could say, you know, lying actually was really the smart thing to do because this is the reason why. That's called intellectualization. So there are lots of ways in which we manage our stress around something. Narcissists tend to use three, maybe four styles that they really like. It's projection, compartmentalization, denial, and splitting. Splitting is a hard one because it's such a weird name. It's when we say something's all good and something else is all bad. Think of the bad cop, good cop. That's splitting. So it's when you suddenly someone's perfect and then suddenly someone's the devil himself. They tend to like see people as all something or nothing of something. So watch out for that. If you see that, if they suddenly say you're perfect and you're all great, you're going to take a fall. You're going to suddenly become nothing. You're going to become a non-thing because that's what they tend to do. The minute you disappoint them, you're suddenly, the nugget of gold is going to turn into the piece of shit. So if you see yourself suddenly being defined as a nugget of gold, watch out, the shit's coming next. So that's how splitting works. They split between people like the good child and the bad child, the scapegoat and the hero, but they also will make you. You will be good one moment, the idealization stage, and then the discard. See how that works? But projection is a way for them to sort of disallow or disavow something that's part of themselves, and they make it you or out there. They see it around them. They'll call it out and outside of them. It's really a bizarre thing because it's actually a way in which they're confessing. So if you hear someone say, wow, are you aware of your neighbors are cheating? What do you think of that? Chances are if this is a narcissistic person, they may actually be confessing this, that they are doing that, and they're kind of seeing what you're going to do about it. So they don't always know they're doing it. It's really a strange thing. But yeah, projection's a wild one. So if you hear them talking about something, you probably are hearing them talk about themselves. And this is a way they're handling their own dis-ease with whatever it is that they're dealing with. So thank you so much, guys, for hanging out with me. This was amazing. Really, really amazing.